On the night of the 7th of August 1918, an Australian gunner, J.R. Armitage, lay in readiness for an attack on the next day. In his diary he wrote this: "It was utterly still. Vehicles made no sound on the marshy ground. The silence played on our nerves a bit. As we got our guns into position, you could hear drivers whispering to their horses and men muttering curses under their breath. And still the silence persisted, broken only by the whine of a stray rifle bullet or a long-range shell passing high overhead. We could feel that hundreds of groups of men were doing the same thing, preparing for the heaviest barrage ever launched." And what he's doing is waiting for the Battle of Amiens, the beginning of the 100-day offensive, which was to ultimately end in the armistice in the First World War. At 4:20 a.m., another man wrote, "All hell broke loose and we heard nothing more. The world was enveloped in sound and flame and our ears just couldn't cope. The ground shook." Another Australian sapper, Harold Grant, when he heard of the advance, he wrote, "Great news, the Australians have caught Fritz napping." But of course, there were to be casualties. And one of those that died was Edward Wiley from the 59th Battalion of the AIF, the Australian Imperial Force. He was 28 years old, and we have a description from a colleague of his, Sergeant Robertson, of what happened. "I saw Wiley killed instantly alongside of me by a machine gun bullet at about 5 or 6 o'clock in the evening. We'd gone over that day and we'd reached our objectives and were lying and crawling about in a shallow sunken road, and Wiley lifted his head to look at a machine gun position opposite when he was hit in the throat. Within a few minutes, Wiley, a man called O'Mara, who was shot through the spine and killed instantly, Davis through the back, and Hendry through the head instantly were killed, and Mayle was also mortally wounded, and they were buried at Harbinness. Wiley was a short chap, slightly bow-legged. I think he came from Scotland. He had his leave there a short while before. He was a good soldier and a decent little chap." So welcome to another episode of the podcast that I, Terry Wenham, called Tales from the Battlefields. And 105 years ago, last week, the Battle of Amiens took place over 2 or 3 days. But in this podcast, we're going to focus on that first day, the 8th of August, 1918. It occurred to me recently that the more we talk about World War One, the more we talk about what happened on the Somme and at Ypres and at Passchendaele, and these are battles that ultimately ended in stalemate and disaster and tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of casualties. And we don't often think about what happened in those last few months in 1918. And that all started, that the tremendous success that the BEF and our allies succeeded in achieving all began on that day, that summer's day, the 8th of August 1918. And it's that one day that I wanted to look at this week. We're going to touch on what happened, the strategic plan, what actually happened. But as you can guess with those first few paragraphs that I've just read, we're going to look at the battle through the eyes of the men from the United Kingdom, from Australia, from Canada, and also from Germany. What was it like to be involved in that all-arms battle on that day 105 years ago? Well, we're going to find out. So that night, the previous night, August the 7th and the 8th, it was moonless and fine. It had been a hot, cloudless summer's day. And towards 3 o'clock, a ground mist began to form in the river valleys, gradually thickening and spread it out across the whole plateau of which was to become the battlefield. And under this cloak of fog, the movement of the spearhead force moved into their final positions. And by 3 o'clock, from the banks of the Ancre in the north, down across the River Somme, past Villers-Bretonneux to the Luce, the British and Dominion troops, with the tanks 1,000 yards to the rear, prepared for action. And south of the Luce were the troops of the French First Army, also prepared for action. 12 minutes before 0 hour, the tanks began rumbling forward, guided through the thick mist by white marker tapes, laid out to direct them through the infantry positions, while above the air squadrons circled and swooped, roaring low over the German lines and deafening the troops and diverting their attention away from what was happening on the ground. And then at 4:20 a.m, with still an hour to go before dawn, the artillery opened fire. And this is no preliminary bombardment like we'd seen in previous battles. This is the creeping barrage that had been established midway through 1916. And it crashed down 200 yards in front of the infantry that were attacking. And steel and high explosives shattered the German gun positions that were further afield. And after just 2 minutes, the barrage lifted forward another 100 yards. And after another 2 minutes, a further 100 yards. And behind this barrage, the Canadians on the right, the Australians in the centre, and the British on the left moved forward. The ranks of the Dominion troops dotted along the whole length of their line by the squat, frightening shapes of the 435 tanks, and the Allied advance to the Rhine had finally begun. And behind the lines, General Rawlinson said that it was an anxious and intricate business to marshal 14 divisions of infantry, 3 divisions of cavalry, more than 2,000 guns, some 450 tanks on a front of 10 miles, without giving to the enemy an inkling of what was afoot. Every man would carry his gas mask, a water bottle and his iron rations. He'd got 250 rounds of ammunition and 2 Mills bombs, hand grenades for attack. He had an entrenching tool and 2 sandbags to defend himself with. The carrying parties brought up the rear, and the British Mark V tanks carried huge amounts of ammunition and entrenching tools. Tanks were mounted with howitzers, and they carried stores as well as their own shells, and from the sky, aeroplanes dropped boxes of ammunition for the machine gun teams. They really had thought of everything on this occasion. All of the things that had gone wrong over the previous 4 years at Ypres, on the Somme, even at Cambrai and Passchendaele, all of those things, by now, the Allies had learnt from their mistakes, and here they were ready to put all that learning into practice, and it worked. Secrecy, of course, was going to be a major concern. Surprise had to be one of the major tactics that was going to win this battle. In Downing Street, it's quoted as saying, no previous mention of the battle had been made either to the War Office, the War Cabinet, or to any other authorities in England, so that the gossips on the home front for once did not have an opportunity to give the soldier away. Only a few staff at each level of command were involved in the planning right until the last few days. Of course, it was obvious to the infantry and the gunners they were being trained for a new offensive, but they didn't know where. It was apparent to the men that were moving the shells and supplies into the area that an offensive was due, but when? Every man had a reminder pasted into his paybook, and all it said was, and I quote, keep your mouth shut. So now the scene is set. As I mentioned earlier, this is an all-arms battle. We've got infantry, massed artillery of all shapes and sizes, heavy guns. We've got the RAF in the sky, over 400 tanks. We've got Australians and Canadians, French in the south, and the British all fighting together for the first time in a battle. This really was an all-arms battle from all corners, I suppose, of the world. And I wonder, well, they didn't. The Germans had no idea what was about to hit them. So how did the preparation work? Let's start looking at some of the accounts that were written by the men that were there. There was a man called Private Charles Rowland, and his Mark V tank was commanded by Lieutenant Ronald Mould. And this is what he wrote. He said the main problem was to silence some guns, field guns, which were on the edge of a wood facing us, and inside as well. This we could see on the photographs quite plain, and we did not like the look of them, as they would, if not knocked out by the barrage, be firing point blank at us on open sights, and we did not think we would have much chance. Then he set about with his plan, as how we should work the rotor of the crew, driving in our turns to a certain point, then move around clockwise. So we all got a share on the 6-pounders, machine guns, and the observer next to the driving seat, who also had a machine gun firing straight forward, and this was the first time this task was allocated to me. And the attack was to start next morning at dawn, 4:20 a.m, allowing 10 minutes for the barrage to lift from the front line and move to the next lot of trenches, and so to creep through the defence. The point we were aiming at as our objective was on the top of a slight ridge, and to go 6 miles into this had never been heard of before, and we thought someone had gone crackers to think of such a thing. But that was the orders, and we were all a bit worried. It sounded easy on paper. One of his colleagues was a Captain Henry Smeddle in the 15th Battalion of the Tank Corps, and he said, I gave orders and final instructions for adjusting tracks, gears and various other details too numerous to repeat here, which were to be carried out straight away. The remainder of the afternoon was spent in assisting the tank commanders to test their compasses, adjust and look over the machine guns, cartridge belts, six-pounders, etc. At 9 p.m. there was still much to be done, but as we had the whole of the next day to complete our preparations, I decided to knock off and give the men a good night's rest. He goes on about what happened the next day. He said, I proceeded with the tank commanders to recce the route to our line-up point, and from there to the frontline trenches, a total distance of about 3 miles. We'd had but little difficulty in finding a suitable route, which was a long road that ran up to within 50 yards of the place selected and about 700 yards from the front line, and situated on top of a high ridge from which we could plainly see the German frontline trenches. It was decided only to tape the route from where it left the road. White tape, an inch wide, is laid along the ground to indicate a route in the dark where no definite track exists. He then went back and he gave his final briefing to his men. He said, I gave orders relating to the time of departure and discipline during the approach march. There was to be no smoking or flashing of electric torches, no shouting, whistling or unnecessary noise during the march. Only tank commanders could be allowed to smoke. The glow from their cigarette was to be the method by which we would guide their tanks while waiting in front without attracting undue attention. One might think all these precautions were superfluous and unnecessary, when the noise of the tanks alone was sufficient to drown any lesser sound like talking or shouting. But it's astonishing how a single human voice, when raised, will carry far beyond and above the dull mechanical roar of the tanks. It's obvious to me as I read this that this was so well planned that they're leaving nothing to chance. And it's exactly what Henry Smedell is talking about there. Nothing whatsoever is left to chance. I suppose when you think about it now in hindsight, this was their one and only chance. A bit like D-Day in the Second World War, their one and only chance to finally break the German line, when the Germans were really on their knees by this time. But they wouldn't get a second chance, I suppose. They knew they had to get it done this time without any hiccups. And then finally it began. Gunner Bertie Cox was with the 14th Brigade of the Royal Field Artillery, and he said every gun shot together and the whole thing was off. I never heard anything like it in my life, neither had anybody else. It was about the biggest show that has ever been staged on the Western Front. Several times I could not hear my own gunfire, and for half the series I laid and fired the gun myself. After 3 hours I was practically deaf. We fired our first shot at 4:20 a.m. at 800 yards, and in 3 hours the enemy was out of our range, which is 6,500 yards. Within 10 minutes of the start, the tanks by their hundreds and cavalry by their thousands were passing our guns. It made an awful pretty picture to see the tanks and cavalry looming up in the mist, over the crest just about dawn. The field guns began to pass us at a gallop too, not to mention the infantry, by the hundreds of thousands. Now, commanding the Australian Corps at this stage in the war was Major General Sir John Monash, a very famous man, of course, in Australia. And he said, and suddenly, with a mighty roar, more than 1,000 guns begin the symphony. A great illumination lights up the eastern horizon, and instantly the whole complex organisation, extending far back to areas almost beyond earshot of the guns, begins to move forward. Every man, every unit, every vehicle and every tank on the appointed tasks and to their designated goals, sweeping on relentlessly and irresistibly. Viewed from a high vantage point and in the glimmer of the breaking day, a great artillery barrage surely surpasses in dynamic splendour than any other manifestation of collective human effort. And then we quote again Private Charles Rowland, the 14th Battalion of the Tank Corps. He said that Mould, his commanding officer, looked at his watch. It was 4:20 a.m, time to move. And all of a sudden a mist fell over the area, which pleased us but did not help the navigator. But it did not last long, and we were on our way to the first line with all of the machine guns firing. Slowly moving towards that, we found that the barrage had not killed all the enemy troops, but what was left of them were coming out with their hands up. But it was the Canadians' job to see to them, and we started to crawl into and out of the trenches, being bumped here and there sideways, all over the place. That is actually the sound of one of those World War I Whippet tanks being started up by an engineer at a military show recently. Now, as for the infantry, they knew from previous disasters, of course, they had to keep in touch with the tanks and also the creeping barrage, which was dangerous in itself. And there was a private G.V. Rose from the 30th Battalion of the 5th Australian Division. He said, "We knew we had to follow our tanks, so kept along after them. Every now and then, Fritzies would come running back with their hands up, well-souvenired watches and pocketbooks all gone. One Hun came suddenly in sight of a tank that I was near. He was so scared that he bounded right at me and would have knocked me down, but I poked the old bayonet at him and he steadied up. Their main idea seemed to be to get taken prisoner and to get out of the line at the earliest." But of course, this is war and terrible things happening. War feelings and emotions were running high. Some of these men had seen their friends killed and maybe their relatives, maybe their brothers in previous battles. If not that day, then in the past. They're in the mood for revenge, and revenge was taken by some of the Allied soldiers. Private Edgar Morrow, the 28th Battalion of the 2nd Australian Division, said, "Enemy machine guns rattled and very soon some of our men were down. There was an indescribable noise and confusion. We became wrapped in the smoke and fog and could only find our way by listening for the direction of our guns and keeping our backs to them. Units became mixed and isolated parties fought their way forward. Our barrage got well ahead of us and groups of prisoners stumbled towards us out of the mist. I felt sorry for them. They needed no guard to escort them back. When almost up to the men in front, I saw one of them shoot four Germans one after the other as they climbed out of the end of a trench. Strange emotions possessed me." Gunner Bertie Cox, as we know, was with the 14th Brigade of the Royal Field Artillery, so he's further back. And he says, "By 5 a.m, the prisoners began to go by and this procession continued all day. The thing that struck me as being most funny was the way the prisoners would dangle right along by themselves, no escort to the prison cage, about a mile away. If there were 30 or 40 together, they'd have an escort. But they mostly passed in twos or threes. All alone or four would carry one of our wounded on a stretcher. We spent a considerable part of the day checking them over, getting souvenirs and talking to those who could speak English. They nearly cleaned us out of cigarettes and emptied our water bottles. They all seemed tickled to death to be taken prisoners. They said the attack was a complete surprise. They were used all day as stretcher bearers. The Major brought up some of them to watch us fire our guns. Must have given them an awful feeling to think those shells were going over to kill their own flesh and blood." Again, when I read these accounts, I suppose it's every week that I do this, I don't know, it's just the futility of it, isn't it? I hate using that word. Was First World War futile? Well, not in Belgium, civilians that were occupied for all those years. But it still seems awful to me that there we are, killing each other. British, German, French, Canadian, Australians, we're all the same. It's not like we're fighting ISIS, who ideologically believe in completely different things to us. These people were our cousins. They looked like us. They lived like us. And yet there we were, firing high explosives and shrapnel shells at each other, killing and maiming people that were effectively just like us. Now, these are thoughts that have just come to me. I hadn't planned those thoughts. It's just come to me and often does when we're either on the battlefield or talking about what happened. So what I wanted to do now was to play a recording of one or two of the British soldiers that were actually there on that day. Rather than me reading them out, let's listen to the words of British Private William Gilman.
"Oh, we went a very good distance. I mean, considering we were all on foot, there was no transport. Everything you did that was foot slogged. And you went until you got an order to stop. And you might take one or two lines of Jerry. It all depends on what the resistance was, you see. We were still belting them. Our artillery was still going over, you know, and it was hell, you know. You couldn't hear yourself speak, and shells were exploding all round you, and there was smoke and shouting and hollering and all this kind of thing, you know, and it was a real good old battle, really. And, you know, it got hold of you, sort of. You just knew that you got to get on, and you were making advances instead of sitting on your backside in the trench, you know, and waiting for something to happen. There was a certain amount of excitement in this that removed fear. We cleared the lot in front of us. You would get machine gun posts that could hold you up for perhaps an hour or two. And you've got to hand it to them that they put up a resistance and a line there that was very, very difficult. And I think our people realised that it took all that we got and that they produced to shift it, which we did eventually, because from then on it was advance. From then on it was always advance.
An officer in the Royal Fusiliers, a man called Jim Davis, he was wounded in the battle, and here he tells his story.
I've been going forward, I suppose, about 10 minutes. When I got it, this machine gun, which got me through both legs, I went down, and the bloke next to me was killed. I couldn't see, he was one of my men, I couldn't see who he was because he was lying about 4 feet away from me. I realised then what I got, and I put a turnkey on with my, I took my scarf off, put it round my left leg, and my pistol through and tightened up. And I was lying there, it was daybreak. I couldn't move at all. And then there was a sergeant and about four fusiliers appeared. Told them to move me into a shell hole because there were bullets. I had been wounded again. I got another piece of shrapnel through the knee while I was lying out there, but 2 or 3 hours afterwards from a shell. And I wanted to be moved into a shell hole. I was past commanding anything then, so I said, move me into a shell hole.
And what about the men inside those tanks? Well, Ralph Cooney was one of them in the tank corps. And this is what he said.
We had then the experience of Combury. We knew that we were going to do it properly. And that was all our training was. We knew that we would be used as an attack of surprise without any artillery preparation. So that the going would be good and we could make lots of headway. And we weren't going to be fouled up horrors like we were in the early days. And that we would also be supported by adequate forces of the other arms. And we were. And the thing was immense success from the start. I was commanding a section of tanks, and I went over on the 8th of August in the initial attack. We went over at zero, and everything went according to plan. We had no troubles or difficulties, and we went to our objective, and we reached it. Without any absurd incident, we were just motored straight through and attacked such enemy as we found and saw them off, and the infantry came along and in due course occupied the line. And in due course the two cavalry divisions went through.
Another tank man was called Norman Dillon, and he explains how they managed to deal with the German barbed wire defences.
The anchors were only used after the battle to clear the way for other troops to get through. You could walk through the barbed wire after the tanks on the track marks where the tanks left them. Although there would be 6 to 8 inches or more of solid barbed wire under where the track had been. It shows how thick it was. And it was all flattened completely down, and you could walk on it like a road. But you couldn't take animals over it very well, and you couldn't take wheeled transport over it. So what they did was to get two tanks. And it was all on the front, two tanks together, go into the wire, drop their anchors, and drive away from each other. And the wire would roll up into an enormous ball, and clean the ground, clean as a whistle.
They didn't have it their own way, the BEF, because there was still a presence of aircraft, German aircraft, in the air. The German army was rocking, but they still had some planes. And they called up their aircraft swiftly into action, diving low over the battlefield, harassing the British and Allied infantry. A Private G.V. Rose, we quoted him earlier, the Australian, 5th Australian Division, he said, a German plane now appeared flying low and shooting at anything that it could see. We got to any cover we could find. I've never felt more worm-like in my life. No matter how deep the shell hole, one was still in full view of the plane. Makes you think, doesn't it, of the scenes in the Second World War around 1940 as the BEF are withdrawing up to Dunkirk, and we've seen those films, those images, haven't we, of German Stukas harassing and machine gunning the British soldiers, but also they were machine gunning the refugees as they fled with their pitiful personal belongings. There was a Major Mark Dillon of the 2nd Battalion Tank Corps, and he was advancing on foot. And he had a very narrow escape. He was wounded, but it could have cost him his life. This is what he said. There seemed to be very little hostile retaliation going on, so he hurried on in the hopes of seeing the war from a front seat. Unfortunately, a 77mm field battery had not been overrun and was cracking off ammunition, any ammunition it could find. One of these, a shrapnel shell, burst on percussion between my legs. And that's all I know of the Battle of the 8th of August in person. I was carried down the road by four German prisoners who were more anxious to get out of the battle than even I was. I remember seeing a very beautiful sight in Villers-Bretonneux on my way through. Two or three very dirtily and heavily bearded soldiers clad in camisoles and ladies' panties and nothing much else. They'd had their clothing saturated with mustard gas and the local dressing station had nothing but what they could find on the spot to clothe them with. From there I was evacuated to hospital and there to England. So what was it like for the tank crew inside? Well, once again, Private Charles Rowland, he tells us. He said, it was like Dante's Inferno in the bus. He calls the tank a bus. You could hardly put a foot down for spent shell cases and cartridge cases. And you could hardly breathe for the fumes of the engine, which was red hot by now. Steam from the boiling water and even the oil in the return tank was boiling over. Sweat was pouring out of us. And we kept having a swig of water out of a petrol tin when there was a chance, and the cordite fumes from the six-pounders was nearly choking us. But we could do nothing about it. What he doesn't say, of course, is if they must have been absolutely terrified of having a direct hit from the German artillery, because then, of course, it would set fire to the tank and the ammunition and their petrol tanks, and they would have been burnt to death, as so many of them were. There was carbon monoxide gas that came from the engine, and together with the cordite smoke from the guns, it created this cocktail of misery for the tank crews. Cramped inside this very small unit, the men were often feeling nauseous. They felt faint, they had blinding headaches, and they were thoroughly deafened, of course, not just from the noise of the rolling tank, but from the explosions that were coming from the tank. Rowland again says, we passed the wood into a cornfield. And by this time I was driving in the driving seat again, and we kept meeting machine gun fire, and we had to resort to the old zigzag again. We passed hundreds of Germans with their hands up. These we left for the Canadians to deal with, and in the late afternoon we reached our objective on top of the ridge. The infantry came up and started to dig in, and at last we were able to open the doors and get out, only to fall in a heap on the ground on top of each other, out to the world. Gradually we came round, and out came the bottle of rum, and we came too. We could not believe our eyes. In the valley below, we could see the enemy piling stuff onto their trucks on a train, men pulling out guns to get them away, and they were hauling in observation balloons and trying to put them on their trucks. It was utter chaos. Must have been a great sight, though, mustn't it? After 4 years of stalemate, finally it looked as though the Allies had broken the Germans and it was now turning into open warfare. This is what they'd been planning and hoping for all these months and years. And morale, it must have been really high amongst the Allies, and one of those men that was there was an Australian officer called Evers, and he recorded his own thoughts about the mood of the Allied forces on that memorable day.
The tanks were going forward and taking position after position, the infantry following up behind, and even all the Germans brought their artillery out of their pits. It was of no avail that the Australians got all round them. While this was taking place, the horse artillery were the howitzers and the 18-pounders galloped into action. The horses would be turned round, the guns turned round, and then pooped off their different amounts of fire out there and limbered up again. In the meantime, German prisoners were coming up, and I saw one Australian private actually prodding the rear of a German brigadier, much to the amusement of everybody else at the time. But it was a morning of victory. You could feel the hair prickling up your spine with excitement because we knew that that was going to be the end of the war.
Now, the next account I'm going to read is quite lengthy, but it's definitely the best personal account that I've found of the action on that day. It's about a tank which was called the Music Box, and it was commanded by a Lieutenant Clement Arnold of the 6th Battalion of the Tank Corps. And he had a crew of just two, driver William Carney and a gunner Christopher Ribbons. Now, Carney was killed. The other two were reported missing after the battle. But they finally reappeared after the war, having been in a prisoner of war camp in Germany. And Arnold and his crew had moved 2,000 yards across country to the south of a railway line at Villers-Bretonneux. And this is when they ran into their first trouble from the German artillery. Arnold says, "We came under direct shellfire from a four-gun field battery, for which I could see the flashes. Two Mark V tanks, 150 yards away on my right front, were knocked out. I saw clouds of smoke coming out of the machines and the crews evacuate themselves. The infantry following the heavy machines was suffering casualties from this battery. I turned half left and ran diagonally across the front of the battery at a distance of about 600 yards. Both my guns were able to fire on the battery, in spite of which they got off about 8 rounds at me without damage, but sufficiently close to be audible inside the cab, and I could see the flash of each gun as it fired." Now, he was really lucky at this stage, Arnold, because they were being fired at by these German guns. He was in a whippet, a small tank, and a direct hit would no doubt about it, it would have wiped them out. But the Germans, something wrong with their guns, perhaps, they kept missing their target. Now, his colleague, Gunner Christopher Ribbons, he went on to say, "From the nearness with which the shells were dropping, it was evident that we'd been spotted. By driving a curving zigzag course, we made it difficult for the enemy battery to get anything like good shooting. At first, we could not locate the exact position of the guns, but on getting to a slight rise in the ground, we could see them through the mist. We altered our course slightly to the left and succeeded in getting alongside the guns. They then went behind them. And of course, once the tank gets behind the guns, they can't turn the guns round, and the Germans were utterly helpless." Arnold takes up the story again. He said, "By this time I'd passed behind a belt of trees running along the roadside. I ran along this belt until level with the battery, when I turned full right and engaged the battery from the rear. On observing our appearance from the belt of trees, the gunners, some 30 in number, abandoned their guns and tried to get away. But Gunner Ribbons and I accounted for the whole lot." Now, I suppose the adrenaline is flowing in their veins by now. And after a short while, Arnold pushed on, linking up briefly with some of the cavalry patrols. And he then attacked an area of German billet huts in a valley. And he caught a large number of German troops engaged in packing their kits to try and escape. And he says, "On our opening fire on the nearest, many others appeared from the huts, making for the end of the valley, their object being to get over the embankment and so out of sight. We accounted for many of these. I cruised around. Robbins went into one of the huts and returned, and we counted about 60 dead and wounded. There was evidence of shell fire amongst the huts, but we certainly accounted for most of the casualties. I turned left from the railway and cruised across country as lines of enemy infantry could be seen retiring. We fired at these many times at a range of 200 to 600 yards. These targets were fleeing, owing to the enemy getting down into the corn when fired upon. In spite of this, many casualties must have been inflicted, for we cruised up and down for at least an hour." Now, don't forget that Arnold and Ribbons and the music box were on their own. You know, they'd pushed ahead of everybody else. And of course, it meant that they were vulnerable. And the Germans were firing at them with machine gun fire, and it raked across the tank trying to find a weakness. And eventually it did find a weakness. And Gunner Ribbons tells us that the enemy machine guns kept up a fairly constant hailstorm of bullets on the cabin walls. "We discovered that the spare tins of petrol on top of the bus had been perforated, and the petrol began to run down the inside of the tank. Naturally, as soon as the liquid came in contact with the hot air inside the machine, it began to vaporise, and we soon began to feel sick and lightheaded. Lieutenant Arnold had the great presence of mind to order, 'Gas masks on!' This action undoubtedly saved us from being gassed. The fire from the machine guns became more and more intense, and in one part of the cabin, the armoured plating appeared to be red hot from the concentrated fire of explosive bullets. Splinters were coming through every crack and every loophole." They really are lucky, these guys. Two of them were anyway, and you know, the whippet tank could easily have caught fire. Arnold continues, "We met the most intense rifle and machine gun fire imaginable from all sides. When at all possible, we returned the fire until the left-hand revolver port cover was shot away. I withdrew the forward gun, locked the mounting, and held the body of the gun against the hole. Petrol was still running down the inside of the back door. Fumes and heat combined were very bad. We were still moving forward, and I was shouting to driver Carney to turn about as it was impossible to continue the action, when two heavy concussions closely followed one another and the cab burst into flames. This is what I was thinking might happen. But this man, Arnold, he seems to me to be a natural leader. He doesn't seem to be afraid of very much. And he and his two colleagues are semi-conscious, but he manages to get them out. He says that Carney and Ribbons got to the door, but then they collapsed. I was almost overcome, but managed to get the door open and fell out onto the ground and was able to drag out the other two men. Burning petrol was running out onto the ground where we were lying. The fresh air revived us, and we all got up and made a short rush to get away from the burning petrol. And in this rush, Carney was shot in the stomach and killed. We rolled over and tried to extinguish the flames. I saw numbers of the enemy approaching from all around. The first arrival came with a rifle and bayonet. I got hold of this and the point of the bayonet entered my right forearm. The second man struck at my head with the butt end of his rifle. He hit my shoulder and neck and knocked me down. When I came to, there were dozens all around me, and anyone who could reach me did so, and I was well kicked. They were furious. Now, in the centre of the battlefield, it was the Australians that were attacking. And like the French and the Canadians and the British, they were making progress. They'd reached the village of Framerville when they surprised the German corps headquarters. They were having lunch in one of the houses. How could they, again, looking back on this, how on earth did those Germans not know what was happening? This, I suppose it happened so fast, didn't it? Now, their lunch was spoiled because there was a fusillade of machine gun bullets. It brought their meal to a hasty end. The staff ran out of the building in panic. They were hunted through the village and they were shot down. And whilst this was happening, the crew of one of the cars ransacked the headquarters building. He removed all of the important looking documents. And in amongst those documents, they found a detailed plan of the Hindenburg defence line. And that was to prove extremely useful in a few weeks' time, when the Allies were to attack the Hindenburg line, which was still, what, probably 70 miles from there, I would say? 60 miles, something like that. A long way anyway from where they were. Now, let's have a look at what the Canadians got up to. And there's one particular soldier that I'd like to talk about. Earlier this year, I was not far from Villers-Bretonneux, wandering around the battlefields with some Australian guests. And we came across a beautiful little cemetery called Hangard British Cemetery, which is near the village of Hangard. And this was the jumping off position coming out of the wood itself, Hangard Wood, of where the Canadians attacked on that day. And as we wandered around this beautiful cemetery, we noticed the unmistakable sign of the Victoria Cross. And it was on the grave of a man called John Bernard Croke. And this is his incredible story. He came from Newfoundland and his family moved to Nova Scotia when he was just 2 years old. And after school, he began work as a coal miner. But in August of 1915, he joined the 55th Battalion of the Canadian Infantry. And after basic training, he sailed to England with his battalion in November. Now, like many of these soldiers, he did struggle with military discipline. He had several brushes with authority. Not long after he joined up in November 1915, he was given detention for being drunk. And then just a month later, he was given 6 days field punishment number two for being in possession of whiskey. And not long after that, in January 1916, he was again given field punishment number two, and this time for resisting arrest. He had another 21 days field punishment number two in the following month in February for breaking camp whilst under quarantine. And then he was punished again for drunkenness, breaking camp and going AWOL for 3 days. And this is before he's even gone across to France. But his behaviour didn't improve when he went to his frontline unit in France in April 1916. And he joined the 13th Battalion. And there's even more entries in his disciplinary record. But his comrades had a great respect for him. There was a man called Charlie Hughes, and he said, "This Johnny Croke was a remarkable man. There was not a phony bone in his body. He was a roly-poly guy, feared nothing and didn't give a shit for anybody. He always carried a revolver on his hip, and I don't think he'd have been afraid to use it on anyone who crossed him. He was saying in our company that if you went out on patrol or a working party with Johnny Croke, you'd come back." Now, on the day that we're talking about, the 8th of August 1918, Croke's unit attacked east of Amiens. They soon engaged the Germans that had survived, that is, the opening artillery fire. And within minutes, the Canadians were unfortunately hit by their own artillery. This is the problem with the creeping barrage. If you get too close to it, you'll suffer casualties, and they actually lost 30 men. But the troops passed on to their first obstacle, which was Hangard Wood, and it was strongly defended by several machine gun nests. In the wood, Croke, who was an experienced soldier, he'd had 2 years already in the trenches, became separated from his mates. And when he encountered an enemy machine gun post, he threw several grenades into it. He attacked it at bayonet point. He put the German weapon out of action, and he captured its crew. As he collected prisoners, he was shot in the right arm, but he carried on and he rejoined his unit. They soon ran in, unfortunately, to another enemy position, several machine guns, and they were again held up. Now, although Croke should have been having his wound dressed, he immediately charged forward. He inspired the rest of the platoon to follow. Once more, he routed the enemy with his bayonet. He captured three more machine guns. He killed several Germans and he took some prisoners. And during the fight, he was wounded by machine gun fire, and unfortunately this time it was fatal. It was a popular legend that he said to a comrade, "Do you wish to show your gratitude for me?" He said, "Kneel down and pray for my soul," but I don't know whether that's true. Now, he's laid to rest, as we know, in that cemetery that we found, Hangard Wood. His mother, Cecilia, received a letter from the chaplain of the 13th Battalion soon after her son's death, and this is what the chaplain said. She said he was a splendid officer. He'd done more than one brave deed in clearing out enemy machine gun nests. He could not have done more gallantly, and I'm stating the truth when I tell you that the battalion could not honour his action more highly than he's done. Death came to him quite instantly, and he is buried with his comrades near the place where he fell. In June 1920, after the war, Cecilia Croke received her son's Victoria Cross at Government House in Halifax, Nova Scotia. And it's now on display together with his service medals at the Canadian War Museum in Ottawa. On the 18th of May 1992, which was the anniversary of his, what would have been his 100th birthday, the Sir John Bernard Croke VC Memorial Park was dedicated near where he grew up. And at the same time, a monument in his honour was unveiled in the park. So what of the German side on the other side of the wire? What were their feelings? What did they experience? Well, you can only imagine, can't you? It must have been absolutely horrific for them to be on the receiving end of such a barrage. And then the tanks, and then the artillery and the cavalry. Found a few accounts in various books. And it said that a single tank crawled towards the valley and it nosed around the bushes and the huts. Of course, this is a British tank. And the Germans were running around like ants from a disturbed nest. Another one said, another tank commander said, that the German machine gun crews had been lying in a turnip field, stood up and surrendered. And one German artillery officer said that he'd posted observers in the trees and they could see the tanks crawling across towards them above the smoke. And his two field guns managed to disable seven of the tanks before they were outflanked by the 31st Battalion. And they immediately, of course, surrendered. And the plan had really worked. And as we said at the beginning of the podcast, probably the most important part of the plan was going to be surprise. They had to keep this secret from the Germans, and it worked. Ludendorff, the German commander, and his army group commander, Bonn, were completely surprised by what had happened. The Allies had driven part of the German 2nd Army and the 18th Army back across 8 miles. The German frontline divisions, which had been struck between the Somme and the Avre, were nearly completely annihilated. Their battalions had quite shrunk to nothing. Barely any infantry left, said the Germans. And many of these battalions were surrounded, he says, and had to lay down their arms. And of course, many of their artillery batteries had been knocked out or captured. That man, Ludendorff, it's said that he was close at this stage to a mental breakdown, mental collapse. And this is what he said. He said, "Everything I'd feared and of which I'd so often given warning had here in one place become a reality. Our war machine was no longer efficient. Our fighting power had suffered, even though the great majority of divisions still fought heroically. August the 8th put the decline of the fighting power beyond all doubt, and in such a situation as regards reserves, I had no hope of finding a strategic expedient whereby to turn the situation to our advantage. On the contrary, I became convinced that we were now without the safe foundation for the plans of General Headquarters, for which I had hitherto been able to build, at least so far as possible in war. Leadership now assumed, as I then stated, the character of an irresponsible game of chance, a thing I have always considered fatal. The fate of the German people was to me too high a stake. The war must be ended. He did offer to resign, but the Kaiser turned him down, and Ludendorff uttered those words that are so often repeated when we talk about the Battle of Amiens. August the 8th was the black day of the German army. Me as a civilian, when I read that now, I think about, well, there's 100 days to go, isn't there, between August the 8th and November the 11th, the 100-day offensive. And there were thousands upon thousands of casualties on all sides during that period. And, you know, not being a military man, I look at the words of Ludendorff as early as August and I think, why didn't they surrender then? It would have saved all the bloodshed that was to come. But of course, war isn't that simple, is it? This was clearly a crisis in Germany. And it's said that the most significant events of 1918 didn't necessarily occur on the field of battle, but instead it occurred in the office of Ludendorff. He knew that his army was breaking up from within. And as we know, history is often made in the minds of the men that are the key players in these battles. And I think that's the case here with Ludendorff. He knew from this moment on that the game was up. Turning back to the Allies' side, a Corporal William Kerr, Canadian with their 1st Division, he was involved in the mopping up operation. And of course, we know from previous battles, this was what had gone wrong in the past. They'd forgotten to mop up German machine gun posts and pillboxes, and as they went forward, they were shot at in the back. They'd learnt from this, and Kerr's job was to carry out one of those mopping up exercises. And he said that right now, they went across an open field. We set off in bursts of 50 yards and then went down, but had only managed a couple of dashes when a German machine gun opened up with a vengeance and one man got hit. At the next burst, the brave machine gunner fell, never to rise again. I noticed that the German trench, apparently now deserted, except where the machine gunners were operating, was much nearer me than the machine gun position. So when the next dash was made, I made double the distance, lobbed a grenade into the trench, and I jumped in behind the explosion. I ran along the trench and lobbed another bomb ahead of me to make sure. And by the time I'd gone another 50 yards, what was left of my section was dropping in beside me, one after the other. The enemy gunners appeared now to have gone, and in no time the advance was up with us. It was not long before we came upon the Germans, two lots of three, and one way or another they paid for it, all of them. Kerr was awarded with the military medal, but then he was given a terrible job. He said, I was ordered to take my section and search for dead bodies and bury them wherever we could find them. There were neither men nor time to do anything else with them until later, but they would be dug up again and properly buried elsewhere. The order also stipulated that their identity discs be removed and handed in, and the markers put up at the spots where the dead were buried. Some 7 or 8 were thus put out of sight for the time being, but none without at least a couple of words of sympathy from their still alive mates, whose turn it might be next. And of course they had to bury the German casualties as well, which there would have been many. This was high summer, and of course the danger of leaving corpses on the battlefield would be disease. And there was a 2nd Lieutenant, John Fleming, who was serving with the 16th Brigade of the Royal Horse Artillery, and he came across the grave of a German, and to the man's rifle had been pinned a sheet of cardboard and scrawled in chalk with these words: Here you lie, Brother Bosch. Your pals won't bury you. Hindenburg won't bury you. Your Kaiser won't bury you. And they can't. But the poor bloody Aussie will bury you because you stink. There was a man called William Grover from the Sussex Regiment, and he saw the German prisoners of war moving back. And this is what he said about their morale and the state of their enemy.
And the Germans were beginning to realise now the number was up, and they gave themselves up quite a lot. So I know, remember one party came over with their hands up. There must have been about 40 or 50 of them came over with their hands up. That was on August the 8th. I think they called that the Black Day of the German Army, it was. And so they were just giving themselves up ad lib. You know, they made a bit of a resistance for a start, but not for long, not like they did in 1916. They weren't a very... The lot I saw were very bedraggled looking lot, you know. All sorts, not like the big hefty fellows that we saw on the Somme, the Bavarians, you know, 6 feet some odd. And these were small, like the scrapings of the barrel, I should think they were then. You felt like we were just the kingpins when the Germans were coming over with their hands up and surrendering, you know.
So what were the casualties for this one day, the 8th of August 1918? We know that it had been an incredible success. The 4th Army alone had advanced 8 miles on a 10-mile front. The Germans had suffered 27,700 casualties, of which over 15,000 were now prisoners of war. Allies had taken over 400 German guns and large numbers of mortars and machine guns. On the British side, the losses were still incredibly high, 9,000. There's still a lot of men, isn't it? Dead, dying, wounded, missing. Some of them, as we know, like Arnold, prisoners of war. But that's still 9,000 men. 9,000 lives either wiped out or changed forever. And let's use the Commonwealth War Graves Commission website to drill down into those men that died on that day. The Commission's records show that on the 8th of August 1918, there were 2,338 deaths recorded by the Commission and who died in France. So when I've researched this, I've cut out all of the soldiers that died in other theatres of war. For example, up at Ypres in Belgium and in the Middle East. And I've also excluded the soldiers that died at home in the UK of their wounds. Of course, some of those may have been men that died of wounds in the preceding few days. But let's assume that most of them were battle casualties from that day. Most of the casualties were British, with 1,005. There were 932 Canadians and 401 Australians that died that day. Of the 1,005 British, a quarter of them, 249, have no known grave, and they're remembered on the Vis and Artois Memorial. And of the Canadians, we said there was 932 killed. 150 of those are remembered on the Vimy Memorial at Vimy Ridge. And the Australians lost 401. 53 of those are still missing and are remembered on the Villers Bretonneux Memorial. But 237 of them do actually have a grave, and they're buried together in the cemetery at Villers Bretonneux. The largest concentration of burials within Commonwealth War Graves Commission cemeteries is at the Heath Cemetery, where there's 191 burials from men that died that day. And at Beacon Cemetery in Sailly-Lorette, there's 155 in there. And there's 42 Australian casualties that are buried in the Adelaide Cemetery, which is near Villers Bretonneux. The records also show that there were 5 17-year-olds that died that day. It also says that there are 2 soldiers that were over 50, both of them Canadians, but when I looked in their service records, it must have been a mistake, because the service records prove that they were both in their 40s. So there we go, quite an extraordinary story, all about one day, the start of the 100-day offensive. So many stories to tell, we've only touched on a few of them. Do recommend, if you go to the Somme, you stay on the Somme, the main 1916 Somme battlefields. If you travel, half an hour at most, you get to Villers Bretonneux. And then you can walk parts of the battlefield. The battlefield, as I said earlier, it's just to the east of Villers Bretonneux. Fantastic views, beautiful countryside. There's the large cemeteries that we've talked about that are scattered around, but also you've got quite a few original battlefield cemeteries that were not concentrated. The one I mentioned earlier was Hangard Wood Cemetery. Absolutely beautiful place. That's the one where we've got the Victoria Cross in. And you're in the middle of the battlefield there. If you go there, not many visitors. I remember looking in the visitors book there hadn't been many people visit there, But it's well worth a day of your time to come away from the 1916 battlefield, go and look at the Battle of Amiens in 1918, and hopefully think about some of the soldiers, some of the tanks, some of the actions, some of the casualties that we've talked about in this podcast. And finally, I'd like to mention the sources that I've used for this, obviously the Imperial War Museum, but there's been three books that I've relied on too, and I want to mention those now. Firstly, I used Andy Rawson's books. Andy has written a whole series of books about the British on the Western Front in the First World War, and he wrote one called Advance to Victory, July to September 1918. That was the first one I used to get the background. I then used a book by Barry Pitt called 1918, The Last Act. And a lot of the personal accounts came from Peter Hart's superb book, 1918, A Very British Victory. Peter worked at the Imperial War Museum for many years and was involved in recording these interviews with the veterans. And many of them came from Peter's sources there. So very grateful to those three people who wrote those books. And all it remains for me to do is once again thank you for tuning in to my podcast, Tales from the Battlefields. Be back again next week with some more stories. And we'll sign off as usual by playing The Last Post in memory of all of the Commonwealth soldiers and the German soldiers that died on that one day 105 years ago, the 8th of August 1918.